Hello and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Milos Forman and his 1984 film Amadeus. Returning on the show today to talk about Amadeus is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So, yeah, well, Milos Forman just recently passed away. And I wanted to, so on the director show, reason why this is one of my all-time favorite films. This is like top 10 for me. I've seen this movie more times than I can count. I can quote a lot of scenes from this movie. And I think this is a movie that just for me hits everything is done perfectly. Whether it's the acting, whether it's the story, the way everything is shot, the choreography of all the opera scenes, I think is perfect. I mean, the music, obviously, with all the music from Mozart, a little bit of Salieri, just everything for me, for this film, it's just, there's nothing that I think could be done better.
Plus, there's like the untold story aspect, because how many people had heard of Salieri before this movie?
Yeah, and it's actually interesting to bring that up, because after he was pretty much after he was a big star, like they say in the movie, he was popular during his time. But once he passed away, he sort of faded away from memory. But once this movie came out, there was a big resurgence in his music. And I believe there's even a Salieri music festival somewhere in Italy. So so it did help his career.
Now, I do have to ask you, since you said it was one of your favorite movies, are you a piano player?
No, I played a little bit of guitar. That's about as much music background as I have.
Yes, I'm a piano lessons dropout. Apparently, though, every single note that you see, when you see them playing it, when you see their fingers on the keys, you know, real rabid people who watch these things take note, every single note played is accurate that you see. So what you see is literally what you hear.
That's interesting.
And Tom Hulse actually only had a little bit of guitar background. And he studied, I don't know, I think they said 6 hours for 6 hours a day for 6 months.
Wow.
So he would be convincing. He's even playing the piano on his back in that one scene. That's really him playing.
That's really him. Wow.
That's dedication.
That is dedication. And this is, to me, this is a movie of so many great scenes. I couldn't even tell you what my favorite scene was because there's so many of them. Like the opening scene is great because it's when he's in the mental ward. And the priest is talking to him, and he's playing him all this music. He's like, you know this? This is very popular in its day. No. You know this? It's very popular in its day. No. And then he goes, but you probably heard this one. And it's da, 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 da. And he goes, oh, yeah, of course I know that one. I didn't know you wrote that. And he goes, I didn't.
Yeah, I also like the little things in there. The little boy that he smiles at when he's playing is supposed to be a little Beethoven. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you're into music, there's so much stuff in there that's like, oh, what a nice little touch. So you're right. It's beautifully acted, choreographed, musical scores without a flaw. But it also has these little extra things in it, which I think make put it over the top.
Yeah. And what's so interesting is nobody in this film is really that well known. Tom Hulse, the only other thing I know him from was he was one of the freshmen in Animal House.
He was also the loser kid in Parenthood. He rolls on home with his kid, dumps him on Steve Martin. Is it Steve Martin in that movie? And you know, the kid is named Cool, and he's kind of like the goofball from Amadeus, sort of the same character.
Yeah. Then you got him, F. Murray Abraham. The only, he kind of pops up in things every now and then, but nothing really that well known. Maybe Scarface, but that's pretty much it.
No, he's in Homeland, though.
Yeah,
he's the bad guy in Homeland. He's one of those actors you feel like you've seen him in stuff.
Yeah,
he has such a presence that you don't you assume he's been in a lot of stuff, and then he pops up in something like Homeland. You're like, oh, he's such a good actor.
Yeah, which is strange because this is an Academy Award winning performance from him, and like you said, he just kind of pops up in stuff. I always wonder, like, why after this movie he never got like huge roles. I mean, you think you get that much recognition, you would get the bigger roles.
Hey, maybe he has an arc kind of like Salieri, where he's sort of unappreciated but great.
Yeah, which is so funny. This story, in the Academy Awards, both Hulse and Abraham were nominated for Best Actor, and Abraham won. So in one way, Salieri finally got to have his triumph over Mozart.
Well, at least there was that. No, F. Murray Abraham was in the makeup chair for 4.5 hours every day when he was playing the elderly version. That seems like a lot of makeup, don't you think?
Yeah. It looks fairly convincing because you couldn't even tell it's makeup because he does look like this old man mm-hmm. in his like 80s or 90s.
I was actually thinking about the makeup thing because with 4.5 hours, I guess you can make somebody look older, but you certainly can't make them look younger. And mm-hmm. one of the people who really wanted the role of Mozart was Walter Matthau. He was 60 at the time, and Milos Forman said, no, he's too old. There's no way. I mean, Mozart died at, what, 35? Yeah, he's just too old. You can't fix that with makeup.
Yeah, I believe another person who wanted the role was Kenneth Branagh. He wanted to be Mozart. Mm-hmm. And I think he said he dropped out when he learned that it was all American. Most of them were American actors and no Brits for some reason.
Yeah, they also thought about Tim Curry and Mark Hamill. A whole bunch of people wanted that role.
Hamill.
I know, I can't see Mark Hamill
at
all.
Hamill doing
but
that.
I can kind of see Tim Curry, also Mel Gibson, Mick Jagger, and Sam Waterston all auditioned.
The Mick Jagger one I could kind of see, rock star. Yeah, and you have them, and then I think Elizabeth Berridge, who another one who I can't even remember anything else. She was Constanze Mozart, and I think she was great in this movie. And that's another actress who, like, this is the only thing I know her from.
Of course, this movie, although it did win Best Picture and everything, I don't think it made the top five, you know, in terms of sales
box office.
Yeah,
probably
but,
not.
But, you know, it's a niche movie, I think. Speaking of the accents, though, I want to mention that the accent convention in the movie is American accents are native German speakers. Mm-hmm. Non-American accents are foreigners, even if the accent doesn't match the language. So they did this on purpose.
Yeah, and, you know, like Salieri and the other guys, the Italian people who are Italian opera, they're not Italian in any way. They have no Italian accents, and everybody who's German just pretty much acts like Americans.
Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting, because you said this movie won Best Picture. You look at the other 80s Best Picture winners, there are these very, very forgettable, like prestige period drama films. Think Chariots of Fire. The only thing mm-hmm. memorable about that movie is the soundtrack.
Song.
Yeah. Like Gandhi.
That was a good movie.
Yeah, okay.
Well, Ben Kingsley.
Yeah.
I can't dislike anything Ben Kingsley is in.
Okay. Then you got Out of Africa, The Last Emperor, and Driving Miss Daisy. Like, none of those movies really, I think, stand the test of time. But in the middle, you got Amadeus, which is a period drama, very prestigious. And it's great. That's what's so interesting. Of those 80s Best Picture winners, this is the one I would say that, like, really stands out.
I agree, although mm-hmm. I still think Out of Africa has some chops.
Okay. And you know what else is, like, really good about this movie is sort of how Salieri is this unreliable narrator. How he, in his mind, he thinks he killed Amadeus. He thinks he, because he had this plan, like, dressing up as his, you know, the costume that his dead father used to wear and forcing him to write this requiem mass that would drive him insane and, you know, kill him. You don't really know if he's really telling the truth. Is he just overly, if he's just guilty, and is this just all in his head? He's a senile old man, or is he telling the truth? And at the end, even the priest doesn't really know. The priest has this look like he thinks he really did what he did.
What do you think?
I don't think he did what he did. I think he's a very, like I said, I think he's this jealousy, which is so great about the movie, is this jealousy of Mozart that even though Salieri is more popular, it's like he's the only one that knows Mozart's better than him. Because remember when Salieri does this opera and he gets this grand standing ovation, even the people who are in his orchestra shake his hand, and then the emperor comes along and says, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. That should be enough for him. But he still knows deep down inside that even nobody else can really know except him that Mozart is the better composer. And that's what kills him the entire movie.
Yeah, I think the story of Salieri is actually the more interesting of the two stories.
Oh, definitely.
Which is, you know, bizarre if you think about it. But yeah, he's eaten up by jealousy that this doofus mm-hmm. is somehow blessed by God with a talent. And he can't figure out why. And it's sort of, since you mentioned Chariots of Fire, you know, anytime you have a movie that involves the Olympics, there's always the person who either, you know, snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, or came in with the silver medal but thinks that they should have gotten the gold, mm-hmm. or some sort of resentment over the person that wins. And sometimes the person that wins is not the more likable of the two, although Salieri mm-hmm. certainly is not very likable. But I think that that dynamic shows up in lots mm-hmm. of stories, and I think it's very satisfying for people because only one person gets to be the best. Everybody mm-hmm. else can relate to second best.
Yeah, one of the best scenes of the movie that really kind of shows what just gets at him, how, you know, this consuming jealousy of Mozart, is when we when he first meets the emperor and they first meet. And then Salieri wrote that little just march for Mozart, and then Amadeus like, oh yeah, Salieri, I did a working on one of your little tunes a while ago, and he goes, oh well, I'm honored. He was like, yeah, funny little thing, but in the end, it produced some good value. Now Amadeus didn't really mean anything by that, but to Salieri, it's the biggest slight ever.
Oh right, it was an insult, a professional insult.
And then not only at that part, but then when Mozart is working on the little march, and he completely changes it around and makes it a lot better. It even hits at him worse that it's just consuming him. And then even the other great scene in the movie is when it's the party and Salieri sneaks in, and then, you know, everybody's telling Mozart, play Bach, play this composer. And then he says, play Salieri. And he goes, no, that's a challenge. And so he has this goofy face while he's playing the music. And then at the end, he pulls up his shirt and farts. That's just, he's being silly and being immature. That's his character. He doesn't mean anything by it, but once again, Salieri takes it as the greatest insult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not reverent. Mm-hmm. It's not approaching the instrument with reverence. It's not like he's not taking it seriously. Let's talk about Tom Hulse as Amadeus, though. I read that he studied John McEnroe, the tennis mm-hmm. yep. star, to try to get the right arrogance for the role.
Yeah, and I remember reading the review of this movie by Ebert. He kind of compared him, especially with the pink hair, to a punk rocker like Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols. And I think really he's really like a rock star in mm-hmm. this movie. Not only the way he's treated and adored, but the way he's this hard partier, he's this heavy drinker, he stays out late, and just the way he just sort of has this reckless attitude. He's extremely talented at what he does. He's extremely hardworking, but he loves to party. And he just likes to stick it up the face of the establishment. He's always fighting the establishment to get his work the way it is. Just kind of a bit like a rock star. He was really like a Jim Morrison, and he died young, just like a rock star. So he was like a Jim Morrison or a Jimi Hendrix, like 200 years before those guys were even born.
That's why it would have been kind of interesting to see Mick Jagger do the role.
Yeah.
Because he would have put that in there. You know, he could not, right? I mean, he would have to like go over the top with it. What about the laugh?
Oh, I love the laugh.
Do you love the laugh? You know what it reminds me of, though, is the guy laughing in Rashomon.
Oh, Toshiro Mifune?
Yeah.
He's his laugh is deeper, though.
Yeah, but it's really over the edge. Mm-hmm. You know, when you show it to people who aren't used to the movie, that stands out as the most annoying thing.
Yeah, and once again, that's just it. That laugh is played great because the very last scene when he's going, mediocrities everywhere, I absolve you, I'm the king of mediocrities. The very last thing you hear in the movie is, oh, it's the laugh is still getting on him. And even that scene when he sneaks into the party, he doesn't even know Mozart's there. But then when he goes, oh, he just has this look. Where is he?
Where is he? Yeah, he's around here somewhere. Yeah, Tom Hulse said that laugh was something he created for the movie, and he couldn't do it on cue. So when they went back later for looping, he had to try to get in the mood because he just couldn't pull it out of nowhere. It was, went with a slightly crazed persona.
Yeah. And even like the first time we see him, he has that laugh and just makes everyone uncomfortable because the emperor tells this joke about, you know, how he met Mozart as a kid and as a kid, he did something silly. And then everybody's laughing, and then Mozart goes way over, goes, oh! And then everybody's just like, what?
Yeah, what is that's with that guy?
And like in other ways, which is when we talk more about Milos Forman later on, this, which is a lot of what he usually does, this is like a youth film in a way. Mozart could, like you said, he's a rock star. He's, you know, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles of the 60s. And
portrait of the artist as a young man.
Exactly. He's this guy, he loves what he does. He's very passionate, but he's always having the suits and the upper people. And this way it's the royals of Austria and Germany, and they have to censor his work, and they say you can't even like have people dancing because we forbid it, you know. And he's always trying to, you know, it's like, well, we can't let you do this work because it's too political. In a way, it's sort of, they don't understand how good he is. They just want something, you know, very...
That they can manage.
Safe and manageable. And he's the one that wants something to do challenging, big and grandiose and powerful. And he's very much, like I said, like he's like a teenager and the and like they're the stuffy old people.
It's also a little bit like VH1 Behind the Music, where they go, you know, into the past and they interview all the people who didn't like the guy, mm-hmm. and interview everybody who can tell you something, you know, you didn't know before. And then you walk away with a different outlook because you saw something you didn't see before, with as much salacious stuff as they can get in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have to talk a little bit about historical accuracy in the movie. Now, this film isn't meant to be entirely 100% historically accurate, but I still think that people... When people talk about this movie, like, oh, come on. Like, Salieri had in real life had nothing to do with the death of Mozart. He wasn't that crazy. He didn't dress up as, you know, the ghost of his dead dad to get a requiem mass and everything. It's completely it's a complete falsehood. But there's a couple of good videos on YouTube that kind of show that it's more historically accurate than you think. There's a guy called History Buffs, and he did like a 30-minute video on the backstory. So with this portrayal of Mozart, it's actually pretty accurate. He was a hard drinker, and he was extremely immature. He was quite fond of flatulence in fart and poop related humor. If he was alive today, I bet like he would love like Adam Sandler and Farrelly Brothers movies. Like if you watch Dumb and Dumber in the scene when Jeff Daniels has explosive diarrhea in the toilet, that would probably like Mozart's favorite movie scene of all time.
He would be on Jackass.
Yeah.
He'd do the music for Jackass. Yes, he's like a frat boy.
Yeah, perfect description. Yeah. And so you have that in the movie, and like some people say, well, Salieri wasn't this hack composer, or he wasn't this bad composer that, you know, the movie is saying is. The movie isn't saying he's that at all. They're saying he's a very talented composer. It's just you've got one that's like a B+, and you got one that's like all-time classic A+. And I...
The question is, would Salieri have been more famous if he wasn't in Mozart's shadow? If there was no A-plus guy,
great point, yeah.
Does that make Salieri, instead of a B+, an A-?
Mm-hmm. And while obviously he didn't have anything to do in real life with Mozart's death, during later in his life when he was going senile of age, he did say he did for a couple of claims to have killed Mozart. And so that's sort of how this rumor started. And there was actually a play like in the 1830s, 1840s or whatever, maybe like 1820s, about like how Salieri killed Mozart. So this was a rumor that started a long, long time ago. And it's mainly because, you know, Salieri in his age of senility thought that he had something to do with Mozart's death.
You know, speaking of historical accuracy, in my classes, I bring this up all the time with movies, and we'll usually take a look at a movie like The Last King of Scotland, for example, mm-hmm. and I'll say, this is based on a novel, so I mean, already you know that somebody took liberties with the story, but what I want the students to think about is, how does that affect the story? Do I think poetic license means you can do anything, or even if it's, as long as it's... about somebody's life, it should kind of take a documentary approach. And either, you know, there's no right answer. You know,
yeah,
it's really getting
point.
You to think about the ethics. But I'm squarely on the side of a story is a story.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no way to know the 100% truth about everything.
Yeah.
If we watched a movie that was completely faithful in a documentary, we'd have to spend a third of the movie watching them sleep.
Yeah, it'd be boring.
Nobody wants to see that part.
Yeah. And I say when it comes to that, as long as it isn't 100% character assassination... Like, say you make a movie, let's say you make My Life movie, and then it was like, you know, he killed people or he was a hardcore racist or something. That's character assassination. So you shouldn't do something like that. But as long as you're playing around with the story, I mean, you know, look, there's a movie called Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Like you can do stuff like that as long as, you know, you're not trying to be 100%, you know, historically accurate. Inglourious Bastards. Obviously, that didn't happen in World War II. That's still a good movie regardless.
That's a really good point. Yes, I think you can get too wound up in whether something is historically accurate. Mm-hmm. You can't really recreate it anyway.
Yeah,
because
you can't.
Think of it this way: if you were doing an autobiography, there's stuff you're going to leave out, and you're mm-hmm. the expert. Can you think of anybody who knows you well enough to really tell your entire life story? No.
And, you know, one more thing about the historical actor I want to point out. So the people say, well, the whole part with, you know, the him dressing up as the costume of Mozart's dad and torturing him is completely false. Not entirely. It wasn't Salieri that did that. And no, the guy didn't dress up as the ghost. But there was this guy who did order Mozart to write music for him, a Requiem Mass. And it was a couple years before his death. And this guy, I forget the guy's name, but he was famous for like kind of mooching off other people's works. Like, I'll pay you this money, write this music for me. And but they didn't know he would claim it as his own. Like, I wrote this. And so that's sort of how that spawned. So there, it, like I said, like you, now, like you said, it's historically accurate. It's not 100% important. But I do think this movie gets a little bit of jab as like, oh, it's completely fictional. When there's some, there's definitely a lot of truth in it.
Plus, I think the truth of the story is in the jealousy. Story, definitely. Which is an emotional thing that you have to render in a way that is watchable.
Yeah, and like I said, the really, like I said, the, like you said, the strong point of that movie is just watching how consumed with just jealousy, and you know, that Salieri has over Mozart. Like you, like we've said, even just the slightest little insult that it's not even meant as an insult, he just takes it as the worst offense ever.
Mm-hmm. Because he doesn't understand why God is letting this happen, why mm-hmm. he isn't giving that talent to him. Because he would use it in his mind responsibly.
Mm-hmm. Which was, once again, another fantastic scene in the movie is when he's trying, you know, the first thing he's trying to figure out who Mozart is. And he's looking around and he's figuring it out. And then he goes in this room where all this free food is. And then he sees this, you know, this kid, this young adult rolling around with this woman and making out with her and everything. And then the guy goes, oh no, they're starting without me. And then he has this look. He goes, no, it can't be him.
But it is.
Yeah. Interesting enough, this was shot in Prague, all over Prague, and one of the places they shot was the Estat Theater, and the Estat Theater is an old opera house that goes back to the 1700s, and this is is actually where Mozart debuted, I believe,
Don Giovanni,
and one other. It was called something Titus. So that's in like the way that shot. It feels very Barry Lyndon-ish with the natural lighting, because especially that old like ratty looking opera house at the end when it has like the goofy comedic opera. It looks like something from the 18th century, and that really really brings in for me.
The Don Giovanni scene was shot in part on the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. And during one take, when Milos Forman said action, a large American flag unfurled. 500 extras stood up and started to sing the Star Spangled Banner. The only extras that did not were about 30 people. First thought to be average people, but it was deduced that these were members of the Czech secret police. Yep. Way to blend.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we talk a little bit now about Milos Forman, because this was shot in the Czech Republic, and this was the first time he was back in the Czech Republic in almost 20 years. He started out directing. I've recently just kind of gone through all his Czech films. One was called Black Peter. The other one was called Loves of a Blonde. The last one he did was called The Fireman's Ball, and that one was sort of, it's like a comedy of errors about this fireman's ball. Like, these guys plan everything and everything goes wrong. It's a funny movie. I highly recommend it. But it was meant to be a bit of a jab at the sort of Czechoslovakian Communist Party. And then while he was going overseas and promoting that film, the Soviets came in and took over the Czech Republic. And so he just stayed, you know, he was in London at the time, then he moved to America permanently. He never went back. So, like you said, this was the first time he was back, and then everyone in the crew was evaluated by the secret police.
I think his most famous movie is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mm-hmm. But I actually use Goya's Ghosts in one of my classes, which is about the famous painter. And also, I really liked The People versus Larry Flint. I thought that was a really outstanding movie at the time when I saw it. I thought it was very, very powerful. He also did Man on the Moon, which I did not see, but he named his two kids Andrew and James, after Andy Kaufman and Jim Carrey.
Yeah, it's a typical biopic. Jim Carrey gives a good performance. It's fine. If you like Andy Kaufman, I would recommend it, but it's nothing special. But
By the way, I forgot to mention a few other people who were considered for Mozart who are interesting choices. David Bowie.
Oh, that'd be good.
Well, I think he would have been even better than Mick Jagger. And Mikhail Baryshnikov, who I think could have pulled it off too. Mm-hmm. He has that stage presence because he's a dancer.
Yeah.
And he looked right too. And also, this never would have worked, but Burt Reynolds was an early candidate for Salieri, which I cannot picture at all. And also, Bert, I don't
Burt
know if you
Reynolds
noticed,
is an Italian. That makes perfect sense.
There's a really young Cynthia Nixon in there.
Yep, I saw her.
As a maid. Mm-hmm. She was 17 at the time, so they had to work around the fact that she was trying to finish school.
Oh, cool.
I never thought of her as a child actor.
Mm-mm. And like when you're talking about the other Milos Forman films, it seems like, especially with Cuckoo's Nest, which is also a fantastic movie, he's always very centered on youth and anti-establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just watched Loves of a Blonde and Black Peter. Those are both kind of about like youth films, and it's kind of like this rock and roll feel to it. And then even like you look at like People versus Larry Flint, that's a guy that's standing up to, you know, the establishment, you know, let me publish my dirty
First
magazine.
Amendment, yep.
Yeah, First Amendment. You know, Man on the Moon, it's I want to stick it to everybody who thinks what comedy is. I'm going to give them something weird and, you know, may not even make that much sense. It's like anti-humor.
Counterculture.
Yeah, counterculture. And he was always, and he did like Hair, which is like kind of hippie stuff.
Yep,
yeah.
So you're
he
right.
kind of always, I was like interesting, he always kind of has that theme of his movies.
I would have liked if I was an actor to be directed by him because he directed 8 different actors in Oscar-nominated performances. Mm-hmm. Jack Nicholson, Louise Fletcher, Brad Dourif, Howard E. Rollins Jr., Elizabeth McGovern, F. Murray Abraham, Tom Hulce, and Woody Harrelson. Nicholson, Fletcher, and Abraham won. That's pretty amazing. He must know what he's doing.
It seems like he's not as well known as other. I mean, he's won 2 Oscars for Best Director. Both those films won Best Picture. He's had a lot of other great films under his belt. And it seems like he's a guy that, if you tell me, like you'd ask the average film fan who Milos Forman is, they may not know or just know him like from Amadeus and Cuckoo's Nest.
Of course, you have to wonder now, since we're thinking about it, was he always walking around the whole time going, that's Steven Spielberg. I don't understand why God gives him all the riches, and I'm over here with my fabulous talent being underappreciated.
Well, he did beat Spielberg in 75. Cuckoo's Nest beat Jaws. I'm okay with that. I don't know if you are, but I'm
no,
okay,
I'm
with,
okay
it.
With that. Yeah, I'm okay
upset.
With that.
Yeah, so what would you say is your favorite? I mean, this is obviously my favorite, but I still think Cuckoo's Nest is a great film. That's probably my second. So what are your other favorite Milos Forman films?
I have to say Goya's Ghost, but it is really a tough watch because it's talking about the Spanish Inquisition. But great Javier Bardem movie that a lot of people haven't seen. Really, really tough movie to watch. Natalie Portman's in it. It's got a great cast, great story. But it's one of those historical situations that you're glad you saw it once.
Yeah. So you watch the film and you expect the Spanish Inquisition?
You do expect, and it delivers. It gives you the Spanish Inquisition. And now I want to ask you if you have a favorite piece of music by Mozart.
Oh, I don't know. The beginning that's played during, you know, the of all the pieces in the film, that's probably my favorite.
I think the only piece I ever learned on the piano was the Magic Flute. But my favorite piece is from The Marriage of Figaro that they use in The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yeah, that's a great
piece. Such a great piece of music. I want that at my funeral one day. Such a soaring piece of music. Inspired.
Okay.
Incidentally, the name Amadeus means of God or love of God, but the word Mozart means sloppy.
Wow, really?
Yes.
That is very coincidental.
And ironic and sort
very
of perfect.
Ironic. Perfect. Anything else you want to bring up? Oh, one thing I forgot to talk about was there was a director's cut released in 2002 with like 20 minutes of extra footage. You don't need to watch it.
I did.
The only thing I remember about it is Elizabeth Berridge. Oops. Like, that's the only thing notable about it, honestly.
Well, hey, at least there's that.
At least there's that. It makes it from a PG to an R rating. All right, then the last question we'll have is tell us a little bit about the classes. I guess we're done with the semester, but what you have coming up in the fall?
In the summer, I'm doing American cinema, and I'm also doing study abroad to Denmark. And then in the fall, I'm teaching intro to film, American cinema, world cinema, and film and philosophy with Dr. Helen Mitchell.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Armchair Directors. We've been talking about the 1984 film Amadeus, directed by Milos Forman. Don't forget, you can listen to the Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying there are simply too many notes. That's all. Just cut a few and we'll be perfect.